Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road, when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man, I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man, I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man, I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston, Texas.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Thank you very much, Audrey, and I'm glad you got here on time. I knew you were running a little bit late, and like always, you're right here to get the show started, and thanks one more time. Welcome to the Blog Talk Radio Network, ladies and gentlemen. I'm your host, Keith Haley. This is the Jumble Justice Radio Show, sometimes more jumbled than others. We've had some technical problems over the last couple months, but I'm not sure whose problems they are. But anyway, that fits in with our show tonight, because our show tonight is going to be about technological things, which I kind of like. I guess, you know, I invented the internet, but but anyway, I was Radio Shack's best customer at one time in terms of building computers and buying all kinds of other extra equipment, and that's what I did in that organization called the Marine Corps, and we have a news story about that Marine Corps tonight. We'll go over rather quickly. So I'm your host, Keith Haley, and we want to thank Emily and Mike, and of course Lucy is here tonight, and we're doing a one-liner Bond joke tonight, so Lucy's not going to do it. She says, I refuse to do a one-liner. She wants a page of joke text. That's okay, Lucy. We'll put out, actually, it's kind of a joke, but I'll do the one-liner tonight for our 1,463,000th Bond joke. Here we go. The show, if you've heard it before, it's about criminal justice news and events and that kind of thing, and the one tonight is about that also. I should go ahead and say it. We're going to talk from Phil Lapsley, present his book. And Phil, by the way, is a co-founder of two different technological companies, and he has 19 different patents. And that's probably not easy to do. Maybe you can get a couple, but 19 is real hard. And title of his book is called Exploding the Phone, The Untold Story of the Teenagers and Outlaws Who Hacked Ma Bell. And it's very interesting. If you know nothing about this subject and don't care, it'll still be fun, because you'll find out what was going on with telephones in the prior to 1960s and the 70s, and how some of these characters figured out how to hack these phones. And a lot of this had to do with the shortage of telephone operators. They would only hire women in those days, and many companies were short. They couldn't get enough women to do this, so they came up with this, well, I'm giving too much away. I'll let him tell the story. But they came up with this little technological idea that eventually allowed hackers to hack in on Ma Bell. Anyway, it's an interesting thing. And, of course, somebody had to investigate these things, and that would be the FBI, perhaps a couple other agencies and some local state criminal justice agencies. We want to thank Alan Levy, of course, CEO of Blog Talk Radio. He's the genius behind the medium, as we say, and now there are thousands and thousands of shows with famous people of all brands and types of interest, and you go on blogtalkradio.com and take a look and see what's on there. And remember, you can have your own show. It can be on about anything that's legal. And I think all the shows that I've looked at have been legal and decent. Some of them, you know, are topics I'm not interested in. The fishing show, do you watch? I don't know. I haven't looked, but I bet there is one. I'm sure there is. That's a big industry. But anyway, that's what we're going to do tonight is listen to Phil Lapsley, co-founder of those companies, and he's going to tell us about hacking in on the phone system. Okay, let's do a blonde joke tonight. Here's the blonde joke tonight, and I'm going to do it, Lucy. Here it is. Did you hear about the blonde that put lipstick on her forehead so she could make up her mind? Well, thank you for that applause. We found that blonde joke ourselves, so didn't have anybody look it up for us. Or did I make that one up? No, I didn't make that one up. Some nights I've made it up and I didn't tell you that. Okay, we're going to have the Ohio Coalition play their famous public service announcement where they're trying to get the criminals to turn in their guns. And, of course, guns. Are you tired of the gun topic? I mean, it's important. It's a Second Amendment issue, and we need to pay attention to it. I got a news story tonight or two about it, and sometimes they're trying to run things by us. President Obama, by the way, made a mistake. He was talking about was he talking about Sandy Hook or the shooting in Colorado? I can't remember which one, but today or yesterday he made a mistake. He talked about the guy had two automatic weapons. The guy did not have any automatic weapon. He had two semi-automatic weapons. So people are still very confused about that. And you heard about the woman, the legislator. She was from Colorado, and she answered a question, and she said that the shootings, you know, if we outlaw these magazines, that that will restrict them eventually as people use the magazines and they throw them away. Eventually there won't be any more magazines because you can't buy anymore. Well, what the woman was making a mistake about magazines and clips, they're not disposable. They're reloadable. You could put more ammunition in. But these are the people that are sitting. She's on the congressional committee that's discussing this. And she doesn't even know that a magazine and a clip are not They're not disposable. I mean, you use them time and time again. That's why you have them, at least one reason. Anyway, amazing. So let's hear the Ohio Coalition.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
Well, thank you very much, Ohio Coalition. Unfortunately, we still can carry. 48 states in the United States permit concealed carry. Illinois does not. And I see they're now starting to call Rahm Emanuel, the mayor of Chicago. They're now calling him, this isn't fair, but the murder mayor. But he really needs to do something about that. And what I would do is hire former chief police commissioner Bratton from New York City to come in for a couple years or a year and show him what to do with the bad guys on the street. And then they could drop their homicide rate just like New York City did in the 1990s. And they cut it down to a fraction, making it one of the safest cities in the United States now. Okay, we have a green tip for tonight. And this is a pretty simple one, too. This is vacation time. You're seeing all this. Aren't you tired of these tourism ads already on television? Boats and cruises and kayak cruises and hotel deals and all kinds of stuff. But here's the tip for tonight to save the planet. When you leave your motel or your hotel room and go out and eat wherever you go, would you please turn off all the lights? Thank you very much. I knew you would like that. Okay, it's obvious. I understand that. But anyway, let's take a little look at some criminal justice news here in a moment, and we'll see what's going on there. Something just popped up on my screen. What the heck is that? I don't know. does that mean? I don't know. Something to do with the phone. Let me see. Hold on. I'm afraid to push any buttons. I think we're still on the air. We're still broadcasting, so we're okay. Let's take a look at some of this criminal justice. One of these days I'm going to read the iPhone manual. But let's hold on a second here. Yeah, it's working okay, I think. Touch to return to call. Okay, we return to the call. All I have to do is read. All right, let's listen to some of these news stories tonight that are really very interesting. This one has to do with the Marines. And at age 17, with the permission of my parents, who were willing to sign the document, I entered the Marines. And the Marines have been experimenting with allowing women into their infantry units. The other units have done that. The other Army, et cetera, Navy, I think, have done that. The Marines have been very careful, and they say, given their frontline sort of special duties, recon role, that kind of thing, they do not want to endanger the lives of fellow Marines. And only two women have participated in the Marine Corps Infantry Course. They both have failed tests to determine which infantry positions would be available to women, so they've flunked. The women failed the introductory combat endurance test, a punishing test of physical strength and endurance, the Marine Corps headquarters said. And the latest class began March 28th at the Marine Corps base in Quantico, Virginia, with 110 lieutenants participating. 96 men passed the endurance test. 12 men and 2 women failed. The only 2 female Marines that took part, they both failed. And the Marine Corps is saying that Commandant, the General, Amos, he says, we have to be careful about this. And I suppose that's right, because the Marines are doing stuff. We probably, you hear about all these other units and SEALs and all that, but I bet Marine Recon's doing a lot of stuff also. I love this story. I love innovation in any venue that I can find it, but Indian engineers, or meaning engineers from the nation of India, have invented anti-rape underwear, which gives the attackers electric shocks and automatically sends text messages to the police for help. Can you believe that? This anti-rape underwear delivers a 3,800 kilovolt shock to any would-be attacker that has been created by a team of these Indian engineering students. And Indian engineering students do very well. It can deliver up to 82 electric shocks, more than enough to disable any attacker. And it's very stylish. There's a little picture here of the underwear. And isn't that amazing? In other words, you attack and they set this thing up, I won't go into too much detail, where they know that attackers often start or hit the bosom eventually. To bring them down and tackle them. They studied it. So when they hit the bosom, this thing goes off and the alarm, it shocks them and it sends a text message or a message to the police department or and some other confidential number. Isn't that incredible? And these two women are very smart. I suppose they're going to patent. I love that. You know, nobody's ever said anything like, for example, what about these school children? If it's so dangerous in all these schools, these events are aberrations. You know, hundreds of thousands, well, tens of thousands of schools in America have never had anybody do any shooting there. And it's terrible that any of these happen. But, you know, we may be going a little overboard on this. What about making them wear, a bulletproof vest? All children, if it was, we'd save them all, essentially that way. Yeah, crazy. Anyway, I'm not making fun of that. We need to do something about it. But I don't know if we need an armed school officer. School resource officer in every school in the United States. Here's another one I think is kind of interesting. The ACLU is now resisting Harry Reid's gun legislation. Harry Reid, head of the Senate, and the Democrats are struggling to build support for the new gun control legislation. In the ACLU, of all folks, they are often on different sides of people. But most people consider them liberal, that type of thing, but not always. They've defended cops in trouble, all sorts of things. But anyway, they're worried about this, and one of the things they're worried about is the government taking all this information from these background checks. Used to be these things were destroyed like in 24 hours if you went out to buy a gun in a store or from a dealer or something like that. Now they're storing all this, and now what they're worried about is them transferring this between agencies, and that's been against the law. according to the privacy law. You can't do that. In other words, take the gun record. According to the Privacy Act, you can't take that information and send it to another government agency. But what they're thinking now is going to happen, this law does not adequately take care of that, we're now going to start building databases on people in the United States. And guess what? Romania can tell you all about that, as their dictator started that way back early 1970s or earlier. And they built 700,000 dossiers on their citizens in a nation of like 2.1 million people, something like that. So anyway, am I right on? Yeah, okay. But anyway, that's just incredible, and the ACLU said we ought to be paying attention to that. I don't think these bills are going to go very far, quite frankly. We'll have to wait and see what happens in doing this. Now, this is important, too. This has to do with crime. The United States government had a stimulus bill where they granted Indiana University the authority. They gave them $423,500 to study condom use. It's now been released. They want to know what the barriers were to condom use. And we're all waiting on that study to be released. It's now completed, according to the website, and it should be released here shortly. And I'm sure it will be a big hit. There will be people just storming that website to find out what the impediments are to condom use in the United States. Just absolutely incredible. How else can they spend our money? Okay, we did talk about, was it last week? We did. The Georgia town now passes a law that all the residents have to have a gun. And that's not new because Kennesaw, Georgia had done that, but a small Georgia town on Monday passed a law requiring the head of each household to own a gun as a way to keep crime down. This is in Nelson, in Georgia. Some people are against this. They say it's a violation of their rights, but most of the people, the town has 1,300 people. It's about 50 miles north of Atlanta. I think that's far enough away. Maybe not, because of this law. But anyway, Kennesaw, Georgia did that a long time ago for several years. Their crime rate there is significantly lower than the state and the national averages. So what you're telling them is that, you know, you guys out there, they're going to be burglars or robbers or home invasion robbers. You're going to run into every house that has a gun. Other people say, well, that just tells them where they can go and steal a gun. But I think it probably works. It works the other way. So very interesting idea. And again, the gun topic, I hope we'll get over this. I have a book on that, of course, with Liberty and Guns for All, a primer on America's firearms debate, but even I'm tired of it. So I hope we get past this here eventually. So that's it for tonight, folks. What we're going to do now is we're going to listen to a nice presentation by Phil Lapsley. And he is the co-founder, I said, of two technical companies. And the title of his book is Exploding the Phone, The Untold Story of Teenagers and Outlaws Who Hacked Ma Bell, meaning the Bell Telephone Company. So I think you'll enjoy this. Give me a time to get it set up here, and we hope it all works tonight. It should.
I'm always somewhat befuddled by readings because I know many of you, and I know that those of you who I know you're smart people. Those of you who I don't know, I hope to know better after the end of tonight. And you're all capable, I imagine, of reading the book on your own. However, they took away my PowerPoint projector, so reading is what you're going to get tonight. And in terms of the schedule, what we're going to do is I'm going to talk a little bit about the book and read for maybe 20, 30 minutes. Then we'll have questions. Then I'll do signings for those of you who want signed books. And then we will head to Gott's Roadside, just down the ferry building from here, and we can have beer, wine, milkshakes, hamburgers, whatever. So there'll be a group doing that afterwards. Please join us if you'd like. So my book is about phone freaks. And if you were a phone freak, that's great and that's all you need to know. But not everybody here was a phone freak. So a few words of explanation. If you go back to the 1930s or the 1940s, the telephone system was an intensely manual thing, right? You probably see from old movies operators plugging cords into jacks, and that was how telephone calls got made back then. And that worked really pretty well for the volume of calls they had at the time. The telephone company employed about 100,000 women, and they were always women because it was inconceivable that an operator could be a man during those days. They had about 100,000 of these people, but they had done the forecast. They'd run the numbers, and they knew how popular the telephone was, and they knew how popular it was going to be, and they figured by 1965 they would need 1 million operators. And there were two problems with that number. The first problem was that there aren't 1 million women in the workforce in 1965, so, you know, we're screwed. What are we going to do at that point? The second problem is even if you could find 1 million people to be operators, the cost of paying them would just be heart-stopping. So what to do? The answer, remarkably, turned out to be automation. What the phone company did was they built these amazing machines that allowed people to dial their own long-distance calls. This is a huge challenge. Imagine building a machine that can somehow automatically figure out how to get a call, say, from Miami, Florida to San Francisco, California, and talk to the intermediate machines, the intermediate switching machines. It needs to be able to do this all on its own. It needs to be able to automatically bill for the calls. It needs to do everything, right, to put the call through. Except imagine building that machine in 1930 or 1940 when the transistor hasn't been invented, the computer hasn't been invented, right? Just today, if you're an engineer, you're like, well, we use computers, so it'll be great. Didn't exist back then. What blew me away, I didn't really realize this when I first started working on the book, is that Bell Laboratories got right to work on this problem, and they solved it. And they solved it using what Mr. Spock of Star Trek would describe as stone knives and bearskins, right? I mean, they had punch paper tape. They had metal cards with holes punched in it. You know, again, they didn't have computers. They had relays and vacuum tubes. But they built this just astonishing long-distance telephone network that allowed you to dial your own calls. That was, you know, hundreds of these machines, and that was from, say, 1950 to about 1980. They were, at the time, they formed the largest machine in the world. And so that's what the telephone network had become. It had gone from this manual thing with cords and operators plugging cords into jacks to this amazing machine. But it was around 1955, 1960, that the telephone network started attracting some kind of unwanted attention. It was attention mostly from teenagers, some of them were blind, who started looking at the network and really just started becoming interested in it, starting to play with it. What they had discovered was that there were some, what an engineer today would call vulnerabilities in the network. In particular, the entire network was controlled by tones. So the way these machines communicated with each other was just by tones, by these little, they were like touch tones, and then there was a master tone, 2600 hertz, which if you're a musician is 7th octave E. It's a pure tone. That tone indicated whether the trunk lines were idle, whether someone had answered the phone or not. So you've got these machines, they're playing tones to one another. The problem was that if you made a long-distance call, so for example, you take the rotary phone on the front of the book in the 1960s or 1970s, you dial a long-distance call, and right after you were done dialing, you'd hear these little fleeting quick tones in the background that would sound like dee 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 dee. And if you have a certain kind of brain, which I know from looking at some of the people in this audience, some of you do, you hear those tones and you wonder, what are those? How does that work? And if I can hear the machines making those tones, then maybe the machines can hear me if I make those tones. And it turns out you could. And so if you were good at electronics, you could make something called a blue box. And this is one from 1975, just about. And it's a little tone generator. It makes tones kind of similar to touch tones. It makes the 2600 hertz noise, and it also makes these tones that sound like touch tones but aren't. And with something like this, you can control the long-distance network. What does that mean? It means that you could, number one, make free phone calls. But number two, sort of more interesting, you could route your calls manually from one place to another. So say you want to call the phone next to you. Well, that's easy. You just dial the phone next to you's phone number. But what if you want to do something more challenging? Well, you could dial, you route your call, let's say, through Anchorage, Alaska, and then from Anchorage to Poughkeepsie, and then from Poughkeepsie to Portland. And you could, you know, stack up this routing of calls just for the sake of doing it, just because it was an interesting thing to do, because at the end you got to, you know, say hello in one phone and listen a half a second later while you heard your voice from the other phone. In some cases, you could even wiretap people using this technology. So you could actually make a, you could use this, these blue boxes to wiretap a call in process. Now, fortunately for the phone company, not everybody is an electronic genius in 1960 or 1970, and so not everybody can make a blue box. Unfortunately for the phone company, the Quaker Oats company provided something called the Captain Crunch Bosun Whistle in boxes of cereal. It's just a little plastic whistle, came for a free premium. And it turns out if you cover up one of the holes and blow, you get that 2600 hertz tone. And so if you had one of these whistles, you could then make free phone calls. So the phone freaks were the people who figured this stuff out. And it turns out, and you can read more about this in the book, there were the phone freaks who were just in this for curiosity. There were the phone freaks who were in this because they were, you know, they had wanted to call each other. There were the people in the organized crime, bookmakers, and the mob who wanted to use this to avoid prosecution by the Fed. There were the yippies who wanted to use this technology to stick it to the United States government because they said, well, the phone company collects long-distance toll taxes, and so it's a 10% tax on every long-distance call. So if we teach people to make free phone calls, we're depriving the government of the money that it needs to send people off to fight and die in Vietnam. So they had all these different groups that wanted to use this technology. The one that I really focus on, I touch on all these in the book, but the one that this book turns out to secretly be about is about curiosity. It's about the curious teenagers. My book is about people being playful, about being curious, about asking questions like, you know, what happens if I do this? If I can hear these tones, what if the machines can hear me? What happens if I dial this number that's not in the phone book? What if is the theme which just permeates my book? And I'd like to share with you two stories on this theme. One of them is about a blind kid named Joan Grecia, who was, well, instead of introducing him, let me just read about Joe. Hang up the phone and leave it alone. Joe was about 4 years old when his mother first shouted that phrase at him. It was a shout he would hear again and again as he grew up. His mother could be forgiven for raising her voice. She tried to be supportive. She really did. But sometimes her son's obsession with the telephone was just a little much for her. And besides, the shout didn't work. Joe soon turned the phrase into a little song, one he would sing over and over again to himself in a quiet, lilting voice. Hang up the phone and leave it alone. Hang up the phone and leave it alone. Joe was born in 1949. His given name was Joseph Carl Ingresia Jr., but his family called him JoJo. His mom, Esther, stayed at home and took care of JoJo and his sister, Tony. Dad, Joe Sr., was a high school yearbook photographer. Though they struggled financially, they lived in a small but serviceable apartment in Richmond, Virginia. They had a car. They had a dog. In many ways, the Ingresias appeared to be a stereotypical post-war baby boom family. But as we know, appearances can be deceiving. First, there was the blindness. Joe was born blind, as was his sister. The doctors didn't know what caused it for either of them. It cannot have been an easy thing for Esther and Joe Sr. having two blind children. Any parent will tell you that having kids isn't easy. Having two blind kids is much harder. The sort of harder that makes for stress, for anger, for fighting. I won't lie to you, says Tony. Parents fought a lot. Then there was the incandescence of little Joe's mind. When he was three, JoJo would pester the adults to read aloud to him. Before long, he wanted them not just to read to him, but to tell him how the words were spelled. Soon after that, he wanted the adult just to read the letters to him. He would piece the letters together and form them into words and sentences, handling the work of reading himself. Quote, before I was four, and you had to be read to with people spelling the words, he said. So when I learned Braille, I already knew how to read and learned in only a month or two. JoJo didn't have much use for playtime. Quote, I didn't like play, he said. I told the kindergarten teacher, play stinks. Instead of play, I wanted people to read to me by spelling the words. Then there were the obsessions, many, many obsessions. Young Joseph was famous for them. Shower curtains were one. He loved the sound that a plastic shower curtain made as it swished back and forth on itself. Jell-O was another. JoJo constantly asked his mom to make him a pot of Jell-O, saying repeatedly, "When is the Jell-O going to gel?" Then there was his fascination with brassieres. His sister recalled, "It was all I could do to keep him from going outside with mother's bra wrapped around his head." The greatest of his obsessions was the telephone. It started around the same time as he learned to read. Quote, "I used to ask what time it was all the time, so mother started dialing it on the phone. It entranced me how I could hear another voice like that. The phone company used to offer a free recording that you could dial that would tell you the correct time. In Joe's area, that number was 737. Tired of dialing it for her son, Esther and Grecia stuck pieces of tape on the 7 and the 3. Joe could run his fingers over the cool metal dial of the rotary phone, his fingers seeking the roughness of the piece of tape. With this, Joe could dial the time himself. Joe would dial 737 constantly just to listen to the voice. One day, Joe noticed the 3 was 3 holes away from the dial stop and the 7 was 7 holes away. I thought, well, if 3 is 3 away and 7 is 7 away, maybe 2 is 2 away and 4 is 4 away and all that. Joe dialed a number at random, remembering the digits as he dialed. He heard a ringing signal. A woman's voice answered. I asked, "Is this 439-011? And she said, "Yes, what do you want?" And I said, "Oh, boy, I just learned how to dial." Play in the real world might stink, but play in the world of the telephone was fantastic. The phone had interesting things to listen to. It even had people who would talk to him. And it was challenging. It made the ganglia twitch inside of little Joe's mind. It was more than a playground. It was a laboratory, a place where a little kid could try things out and where he could conduct as many experiments as he wanted. It was a world of possibility, a world prefaced with that most intoxicating of words, if. Quote, "The way I learned how to dial sort of characterizes the way I've learned about telephone systems all my life," he said later. "You make a theory, you think something. Then you try it out. You perform an experiment. Had that not worked, I would have either had to make another theory or see why that didn't work," he says. Not simply trial and error, but guided trial and error. Although JoJo didn't know it at the time, the adults had a name for this. They called it the scientific method. Years later, Nobel Prize-winning physicist Richard Feynman would write, "The principle of science, the definition almost, is the following. The test of all knowledge is experiment." So, JoJo went on to become the centerpiece of a network of phone freaks that formed in the late 1960s. And the way they formed was kind of interesting. JoJo had figured out how to whistle free long-distance calls just with his lips. He was good at that, and so
again, don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.